Good morning. Welcome to Current State. I'm your host, Brooke Allen, filling in for Mark Bayshore, who is out today. I just joined WKAR as the new morning edition host, so you will be hearing me in the mornings before Current State soon. It is the first day of summer, of course, and I believe it is supposed to get up to 90 degrees today. So, of course, keep plenty of sunscreen handy. WKAR News Time, 9:07. In Washington, federal housing officials are considering a complaint filed last month that involves the city of Lansing. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is exploring that claim. It suggests that city officials discriminate against low-income minorities by resisting housing projects meant for them. It came after the city council in March refused to grant a so-called pilot incentive to a developer considering a project in Old Town Lansing that would include low-income housing. Opponents of pilots, which stands for payments in lieu of taxes, questions the need for such housing. They also argue that the incentives are depriving the city of much-needed revenue. Mayor Virge Bonaro rallied against the council decision, accusing it of discrimination. And on Friday, Current State's Mark Bayshore spoke with City Councilwoman Carol Wood about the dispute and other issues. Wood voted not to grant the pilot to local developer Sam Sabori. She says she's not clear where the HUD issue stands, but hopes the city attorney's office can learn more.
We're going to have the city attorney's office reach out and see if they can get any additional information on that so that we're able to understand where that is. A pilot, what they do is you take the rent, you back out the utilities, and then you pay a portion of that, which would be 4%, on an annual basis. It doesn't pay school tax. It doesn't pay county tax. It doesn't pay the library. It's just a very small percentage that comes to the city. And when we're looking and hearing over and over again about our legacy cost and trying to make sure that we have enough revenue coming in, four of us on council chose not to support that. Now, the mayor held a press conference after that vote and accused the four that voted against this that of being racist, biased against the poor, and encouraged that a complaint be filed with the federal government on that. So that's where we are right now.
Is there a consensus that pilots lower city revenue? I mean, does everybody agree on the impact of pilots?
I think everybody understands that mechanism, all of them on council. Is there a need for affordable and low-income housing? Absolutely. You know, I mean, we know there are issues out there, but I think we also have to be cognizant of what we're doing when we're looking at properties that have an impact of creating additional revenues at market rate rents. I personally would like to see in these projects that not only with a low income, that there is market rate rentals as well, and that's actually condominiumized, where that would allow us to receive full taxes on those that we're getting market rate on.
You're not an attorney, but you're very experienced in city matters, Carol Wood. How likely is it that the HUD investigation will conclude there was discrimination? Have you thought about that?
You know, I have. I don't believe in my mind that there was any. Do I believe that, you know, just like any complaint, whether it's a police complaint or anything else, has to go through that mechanism? But I think we have to be very careful while we're going through that we don't add anything that would be perceived by the government as the fact that maybe we were being discriminatory. Now, if we had five new projects that came up on the drawing board in the very near future that all talked about market rate housing, could someone then, and we all supported them and they passed, could someone say, well, you're trying to gentrify, you're only looking at those, you're only supporting those projects? That is an argument someone could make. And so I think we just have to be very careful as we move forward during this investigation to make sure that anything that comes before us that we're doing our due diligence on and that we're not creating a hazard for the city.
Do you know who filed the complaint?
No, at this point, we do not. Now, again, I'm anxious for the city attorney's office to reach out and find out what's going on and if they can get any additional information on this.
Mayor Bernero was very vocal in his criticism about the city council's action here. If the complaint gets dropped, would the mayor lose any credibility?
I don't think so. I mean, again, it's his opinion. Do I think as mayor that that's the way you handle that? Could there have been discussions with council members? Do you go out and hold a press conference and accuse half of the council of things that were blatantly not part of, at least they weren't part of my decision, and I don't believe they were part of the other four that voted against this particular pilot. We were not stopping the gentleman from moving forward. Again, he could have gone for a 10% and applied to MSHDA for that. He chose, he wanted 4%. Also, for your listeners, this abatement isn't a 5-year abatement or a 10-year abatement that they get with this pilot. It's the life of the mortgage. The mortgage on this one would have been 37 years. So for 37 years, we would have only received 4% on that, where everyone else around them is paying full millage, which is 19.75 mils.
We're talking with the Lansing City Council's Carol Wood about HUD's consideration of a so far anonymous complaint alleging that the city council violated federal law when it denied an incentive for a project including low-income housing in Old Town Lansing. Let's talk about some other business. You've referred to the city attorney. The likely incoming city attorney, Jim Smirtka, has been city attorney a couple of times already. He has to be approved by the city council, of course, but he appears to be respected with a commendable track record. How do you feel about his appointment?
For this appointment, for this particular person, you know, I was very surprised by the mayor's choice and actually very excited about it. I'd worked with Jim Smirtka from 2000 to 2004. He actually served on council, he served as a city attorney since 1994, and I worked with him as a neighborhood person on different neighborhood issues during that period of time. And he gets it. He understands the role of both council and the mayor. He also understands the fact that there are times you're working for council and you are not relaying all that information to the mayor, and there are times that you're working for the mayor and you're not relaying all that information to council. He understands municipal law. He has, you know, done a number of good things while he was city attorney, and I look forward to the confirmation process next Monday because mine will be a yes vote.
In the past, you've complained here on Current State about all the unfilled job openings the city has had for quite some time, some of them for quite some time. Some of these are in the city attorney's office. Do you think Mr. Smirtka will play a role in speeding up hiring and filling some of these positions?
We understand and have been very cognizant in through our budget process that there are attorney positions open within the city attorney's office, as well as staff, support staff, and anxious to have Mr. Smirtka start the hiring process. We've had some people under contract, and I just think it's important that we get those positions filled so that they're able to service the issues that we as a council and as a community have out there.
Do you think we'll learn the details of the Janine McIntyre severance?
I don't know. To be perfectly honest, council continues to ask questions. I think the most important thing, though, that all members of council have said at one time or another, that they want to see a mechanism in place that council is aware of and knows what's happening before we get into a situation like this again. And that's one of the things that we've asked the city attorney's office to look at, whether it's writing an ordinance or whether it's a charter change that would allow council to be made more aware of what's happening. I know when Virge Bonero first came in as mayor, one of the first things we did was adopt an executive management plan that actually talked about severance pay. That wasn't followed in this process. And those are questions out there that we're asking to try to make sure, why do we pass this policy if it's not followed? And we need to follow up on that. I'm hoping that when Mr. Smirka takes over, that those are some questions that we'll be able to deal with him.
The Lansing State Journal continues to report about the fact that it has not received documents about the McIntyre severance that it has FOIA'd the city for. And this is another piece of business that, as I understand it, is handled by the city's attorney, city attorney's office. How big an issue is FOIAs and the city's processing of FOIAs?
I think it's extremely important. The reason, I mean, council even has passed a FOIA policy on July 1st of 2015 that we had to submit to the state, letting the public know how we were going to handle those, the timeliness of them, logging them in, making sure departments were able to respond to that. And when you have entities or individuals that are paying for information and they're months out not getting that information, no response for an extension of the time, those issues are just not acceptable. Government is supposed to be transparent. Part of the FOIA process is to make sure that documents are getting to the public when they're asking those. We understand that there are sometimes issues of privacy, HIPAA, some of those things that are precluded, and we get that. But I think page after page of blacked out information that's passed on to entities that are asking for that with no explanation is not good government.
We're talking with Carol Wood of the Lansing City Council. Once Mr. Smirka is on board, which will presumably be July 1st, do you think the FOIA process, do you think the process involving FOIA requests will speed up?
I'm hoping so. I'm hoping that, you know, that some of the things that he looks at is looking at that. I've heard from Mr. Abood that within a month's time we've had over, you know, 800 requests for FOIAs. I think, you know, part of that is trying to ferret that out. What are those requests? I know in years past there was actually a FOIA officer that handled things with the police department. So the police departments wasn't run through the city attorney's office. They had a legal representative that handled those. Are those what's bogging down the system? Is it the fact that we don't have enough people and support staff and the city attorney's office to follow up on those? We have funded positions that are vacant out there. And to continue to hold these positions vacant when we have taxpayer dollars to put people in those places is not acceptable. We need to move the process along. Yes, we need to make sure that there are qualified people in there. But if you were to look today on the city's webpage and see how many positions are posted. We have two, one for a temporary lifeguard and police positions. We have closer to 100 and probably 60 positions that are open, a number of those on top of that. There are contract people in there that are doing part-time work, and the taxpayers expect more from their dollars.
Carol Wood is an at-large member of the Lansing City Council. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Coming up later on Current State, Michigan is the automotive capital of America, and yet we have some of the nation's worst roads. At Michigan State University, researchers are using a state grant to create stronger asphalt that will help our roads last longer. They're developing a blend that's already showing early signs of promise. Current State's Kevin Lavery reports. Well, today is the first day of summer, so of course the big thing on everyone's mind right now is Christmas. No? Well, okay, all right, just stay with me here for a minute. Just imagine it's cold, the snow is deep and crisp, and your husband, Clark W. Griswold, has just found it, the Griswold Family Christmas Tree.
Isn't it a little big?
It's not big, it's just full.
Dad, that thing wouldn't fit in our yard.
Not going in our yard, Russ. It's going in our living room. Look at it.
It really is beautiful, Clark.
Something else, huh, Russ?
Yeah, Dad.
Isn't it beautiful, Audrey?
She'll see it later, honey. Her eyes are frozen.
Well, you might think it's a little early to start watching National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, but my next guest already searching for the perfect pine. Steve Doty is Facilities Supervisor with the Michigan Department of Technology, Management, and Budget, and he's the guy leading the public statewide search for Michigan's official Christmas tree that will be displayed this winter on the Capitol grounds in Lansing. And Steve Doty, welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having us here.
And Steve, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation was released in 1989, and I understand the state of Michigan has been searching for its annual Christmas tree longer than the Griswold family. So when did this begin?
It started approximately 1987 when Governor Blanchard thought it was a great idea to participate in the Silver Bills activities in the city of Lansing. And so he contacted the Department of Technology, Management, Budget and asked them to lead the project.
And how do you get the annual Christmas tree search on people's radar, encourage them to get involved? I mean, months in advance, today's the first day of summer, so it seems a little early, but is it or not?
Not really. We usually send out our announcement for our search in mid-May and early June, and we start looking for the tree and getting everybody excited about Christmas.
So the tree that's displayed outside the main entrance of the Michigan Capitol, of course, has to be special. So tell us about the criteria for this perfect tree.
We are looking for a tree that's 65 foot tall, approximately 30 foot across at the base, and a 30-inch trunk. And the reason that we're looking for the 30-inch trunk is because we have a hole right in the concrete in the front sidewalk where the tree is placed. If we get the right height, the right width, it will look very beautiful.
I'm glad I don't have a 30-inch trunk. Okay, so how does people can actually nominate the Christmas tree?
That's correct. We send out flyers and through emails and through contacts through our communications department to all the media outlets and to give them the specifications. And then we have an email address that they can send in their nominations. We like it if they can send pictures. It helps out a lot.
So how many nominations do you actually get a year?
Between 15 and 20.
Oh, okay. So not many.
Not many, but we also hold on to previous nominations and look at the runner-up trees and so that we can keep track of them in case they are the best candidate for the current year.
So we are talking about the search for the official Michigan Christmas tree. Each year, the public is encouraged to keep a keen eye out for that majestic tree deemed worthy to grace the Capitol lawn. And of course, Steve Doty is a facility supervisor with the Michigan Department of Technology, Management, and Budget, the agency leading the search. And the Michigan Christmas tree is always given through a donation. So how does that work? Do individuals or families usually have a big tree on their lot that they just really want to give away?
That's what we find most of the time is we have found that the trees flourish best in an area where they've been planted and cared for by a family. Most of the trees have always come from a community. Somewhere in somebody in the neighborhood, some of the older subdivisions or parts of the community, and that's where they seem to flourish the best.
Okay, so you actually have a map with you with a bunch of Christmas trees scattered across it. Tell me a little bit about this map.
Well, it's a map that we've used to kind of keep track of all the locations up at the top in the Upper Peninsula. You'll see there's a larger quantity down in the Lower Peninsula, and it happens that there seems to be a lot of great trees in the Upper Peninsula.
So who actually harvests the trees and then prepares them for shipping to Lansing? That's got to be a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. It's an all-day process. There's other communities like New York and the Rockefeller Center that have a crew that works on that. the federal, we have a federal tree up in the corner. You'll see a little tree that's painted red, and that's the U.S. Capitol tree.
So the red tree is the Capitol tree?
That's right. That went to the United States Capitol.
Really?
Yeah, we helped with the selection process on that. But our process is that we work with the community. Once the donor family has indicated that they're willing to donate the tree, we start contacting all of our resources in those areas. We work with the Michigan Association of Timbermen's and the Great Lake Timber Professionals Association to rally the group together and get enough resources to help us harvest the tree. We'll need a crane that's donated. We'll need a truck with a trailer large enough to haul it. That's always donated. And then all the effort is from the community and from the local associations.
Okay, so again, we are talking with Steve Doty. He's the facility supervisor with the Michigan Department of Technology Management and Budget. His agency leading the annual search for the official Michigan Christmas tree that is displayed on the Capitol lawn and lit during the Silver Bells in the City event in November. Of course, ironic since it is the first day of summer. So, Steve, there have been some really great stories over the years about how the state Christmas tree has been found. Can you go ahead and tell me a couple of those?
Absolutely. One of the ones that comes to the mind the most is that we normally find our trees, as I said, in communities where they've been cared for by a family and so forth. We found one that was nominated in 2011, I believe it, by the Rudy Mackey family from Iron Mountain, but it was at their cottage in the area of Republic. Now, you've got to understand there's lots of little communities up in the Upper Peninsula. So Republic is by a lake called Witch Lake. That's always a joke for people going by. And Rudy's tree was right on the banks of a lake near his cottage. It was a beautiful, gorgeous tree. And after working with him for a little bit, we found out a little bit about this small man who had worked construction all of his life. He turned out to be a ski jump record holder at the Iron Mountain Ski Jump. He was the first person to break 301 feet. I don't have the exact date. And then later in life, he had the opportunity to be a judge at many international ski events, including the Olympics.
So a pretty famous donator then.
Yes, but it was very unassuming. He didn't wear that on his sleeve or anything like that. We didn't know about that until we actually sat down and was having lunch with him at his cottage and noticed some pictures on the wall. And then he started to tell some of the stories.
So you really never know who you're dealing with.
Absolutely.
And then you had another donor who was at Houghton Lake.
Yes, we did. We had Jerry and Beverly Kilburn from Houghton Lake had donated a tree. That one we happened to find as we were driving by. We're always scouting, looking along the roads and the highways for that tree that's sticking up there, just as we did in National Lampoon. You're looking for that perfect tree.
So you actually knock on someone's door and ask them if they'll donate a tree?
That's exactly what we did.
And have you ever been told no?
I have, once or twice, but not very often. But first of all, they're pretty surprised, and then they're intrigued to find out that we have tools that can measure the tree accurately, and sometimes they're really surprised at how tall it is. The trees have a certain life expectancy, and so we're getting them near the time when they're about ready to start to fail and spruce gall disease or something will take over. So we want to get them and honor those trees and the families at their peak.
That is excellent. Thank you so much. So again, tell me, how do people participate? Because this is all done by nomination, correct?
That's correct. So on our notice that will be out in the papers or brought to your attention on your local TV, there is an email or an address. I think it's christmastreemichigan.gov, and that will get the information to us, and we'll be able to take those nominations. We'll list them down, and then we'll start taking a look at them.
Okay, so I have one more question for you.
Sure.
Have you ever had your own Clark Griswold moment where you knew you'd had or found the near-perfect tree and something so big and beautiful that it actually made an impact on you?
I did. Down in Jackson, I happened to be doing some research on my own one day, and I came across a tree that was belonged to the Laporte family in Jackson, and they donated their tree, I think it was 2012, and it was massive. I thought this was going to be the tree to end all trees. It was a beautiful concolor fir, and it was huge. And it was the most exciting thing to see. I kept telling everybody they had to come and see it. So we finally convinced all of the partners that this would be the tree. And then once we harvested, it was the hardest tree to get harvest. So it was a Griswold moment.
Oh, no. So what happened to that tree?
Oh, we got it down there, but it was heavier. It was taller. And it was a lot more difficult to bring together and bind and get tied up so that we could get it on the tree, or on the trailer rather, for the truck trip up to Lansing.
Have you ever had a tree just not work out because it wouldn't fit on the trailer?
Once we get the measurements, if they're too tall, we just have to eliminate them. Or if it's near some live wires or in somebody's backyard, we don't like to put that tree up on a crane and then haul it over somebody's house. Safety first.
Right. So safety first. And again, you like it when people send you actual pictures of the trees that they nominate, correct?
Absolutely. That helps us out tremendously.
Okay. And so when do you end the nomination process?
I think this year we're looking at mid-August and then sometimes you get a few stragglers that come in there, but we'll take a look at those as well. So that's when we're looking, and we start looking at all those nominations as they start coming in.
Okay, thank you so much. Again, we've been talking about the hunt for the official Michigan Christmas tree, which is just getting underway. Steve Doty is the facility supervisor with the Michigan Department of Technology, Management, and Budget, the agency that, of course, organizes that annual search. And Steve, best of luck, and thank you so much for being with us. And, of course, next time I see you, I will have the tinsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Coming up on Current State, we will chat with Current Sports host Al Martin about the Cleveland Cavaliers, who won the NBA championship last night in a thrilling Game 7 against the Golden State Warriors. It's been quite a while since the city of Cleveland has celebrated a pro sports championship, and we will also chat with Al about that, as well as talk about which Michigan State men's basketball players could be making their NBA dreams come true later this week. That and more after the break. Welcome back to Current State on this first day of summer. I'm your host, Brooke Allen, filling in for Mark Bayshore, who is out today. I just joined WKAR as the new morning edition host, so you will be hearing me in the mornings between 5 and 9, and I am looking forward to exploring Lansing later today. I will be out and about hunting for the best coffee spots in town, so if you happen to see me in the WKAR van, make sure you say hello. I will be, of course, the one with 3 shots of espresso. Earlier this month, the state of Michigan issued nearly $3 million in grants to study ways to create new uses for scrap tires. Michigan State University is using its funding to create stronger asphalt that will help our roads last longer. They're actually developing a blend that's already showing early signs of promise. Current State's Kevin Lavery talks with Dr. Eamon Kutai, an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at MSU. He and his teams are experimenting with old scrap tires, and tests indicate that when you grind up rubber from old tires and mix it in with the asphalt, it can prevent or at least slow down road deterioration caused by traffic and weather conditions. And Dr. Kutai calls the substance crumb rubber.
Crumb rubber is made out of scrap tire rubber. Scrap tires that are extracted from vehicles, they are processed into small little powder-like particles. And the metal from those tires and the fibers, they are removed. And in a sense, pure rubber is extracted. And that rubber is called crumb rubber.
And we have no shortage of scrap tires in Michigan, the automotive capital of the world, but they are an environmental hazard if not disposed of properly.
That's absolutely right, and that's where we come in. Michigan Department of Environmental Quality has this program called Scrap Tire Market Development Grant. About 4 or 5 years ago or so, we started applying for that grant to find best ways of putting chrome rubber, that powdered rubber, into asphalt pavements to hopefully kill two birds with one stone, both to get rid of the scrap tires and also to improve the roadways. My past research and also literature also showed that if done properly, chrome rubber modified asphalt pavements last longer than typical asphalt pavements, but the key is if done properly.
Let's back up just a little bit. Asphalt, of course, is a petroleum form. It's very viscous, so it's like a jelly, and it's mixed with components that are called aggregates, that's rocks and gravel and that sort of thing, to make asphalt. So what types of aggregates do we normally find in Michigan that make for good roads?
Typically, what we have been testing in this lab are gravel, and limestone is also used. As you said, asphalt binder, what we call binder, is a viscous material, and it has a very low viscosity at high temperatures, and viscosity increases rapidly as the temperature goes down. So at high temperatures, low viscosity may lead to soft asphalt. When we have a soft asphalt, one of the problems is what we call rutting. Rutting is the permanent deformation along the wheel path. So we typically want asphalt mixtures to be relatively stiff at high temperatures. And chrome rubber particles themselves are a little bit stiffer than the viscous asphalt at high temperatures. So that actually provides an additional stiffness. So that is typically good for rutting. And at low temperatures, it's the opposite. So at low temperatures, the stiffness of the binder, asphalt binder, is really high. The viscosity goes really high and stiffness goes up, but the rubber stiffness remains the same. So it's the opposite. The rubber becomes softer at low temperatures. And low temperatures, the problem is the cracking. And typically soft material, soft asphalt material, is more flexible and more resistant to cracking.
Okay, so if we can commercialize the use of chrome rubber technology, it's going to maintain its properties, it's going to resist rutting and cracking whether it's hot or cold.
Yes, that's true. There are several different technologies. One of the technologies is called the wet process. Wet process is the rubber is mixed with the asphalt binder at the asphalt plant. It's pre-blended with the binder, reacted with the binder, and creates like a gel-like material. So it rubber absorbs some of the light fractions of the asphalt. It becomes swollen, and it creates a link between the rubber and the asphalt. And that kind of material has been proven to be quite effective throughout the country. One of the issues with wet process is initial cost is relatively expensive in Michigan because of the fact that asphalt plants need a specialized equipment, and they do not have that specialized equipment because there was no market. There was no market for chrome rubber modified asphalt, so they did not buy it. So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem. They wouldn't buy it unless there's a market. There's a chicken and egg problem right now. So the wet process, even though it has been a good method, it hasn't been successfully used in Michigan. So there are several different technologies that we are evaluating in Michigan in lieu of the wet process, because wet process is expensive in Michigan.
We're talking with Dr. Emin Kutay, who is an associate professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Michigan State University. Is there something in your lab you can show me that demonstrates your work?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go this way, this is how where we make the asphalt samples. And this is an chrome rubber modified asphalt sample, actually. This is about, if you can touch it, you can kind of feel little chrome rubber particles on the surface.
And yes, I can feel that.
And then if I show you another one without particles. So it's difficult to see the difference, but if you feel with your hand, see, this is much smoother and there are no particles on the surface. And this does have particles sticking out a little bit. When you look at them, they don't look very different, but When you test them, obviously, you see the difference.
As I understand, Dr. Kutai, there are a handful of roads in mid-Michigan, in this community, in which you have already placed some samples of this chrome rubber material. Where are those places? When was that installed? Are we seeing any results yet?
Yes, the first test section we built was at Waverly Road, between Jolly Road and I-96. There's about a mile of test section there. The second test section is on Hazlett Road, between Park Lake Road and Okemos Road. That's also about a mile. That was built in 2012. Third test section we have is the Cornell Road between Grand River Avenue and Hazlett Road. That's a new technology actually we developed here in our lab. It's called hybrid chrome rubber modified.
Well, a couple of these roads are not far from where I live. So if I took a test drive on these roads you're talking about, am I going to feel any type of difference?
It's kind of too early to see big difference at the moment. It has been, you know, at least they haven't prematurely deteriorated very, very much. So we do see some cracking in both of the sections. That is not necessarily related to the materials. It's related to what was underneath. There was an old concrete underneath, and that started creating some reflective cracks in both sides, both control and the chrome rubber sections. Hopefully we'll be seeing much better answers in the future, 5-6 years from now, hopefully.
My takeaway from that statement then is politicians and the public don't necessarily have a lot of patience in waiting for good roads, but as an engineer, as a scientist, you have to have patience. You have to let the process take hold.
That's true. And some of these may fail. And the failure is not necessarily the failure of the material itself. We are trying to test the material, we're trying to introduce a new material. But there are lots of things that go on during construction. There could be a lot of other problems. There could be problems of segregation. There could be problems of during construction non-uniformity, and there could be problems of base upgrade. So there are many, many things that go on. So even if some of those roads fail, or even if some of those roads do not show the superior performance of chrome rubber, that's not to say that that's the end of it. And there are many other. As MSU, we are one of the recipients of this grant, but there are many other test sections throughout the state that are built by different counties and receiving the same kind of grant. So it's very good that those sections are also available and for public to see. So my take on this is hopefully some of these sections will perform the best. And again, this is a research. We are trying to find which technology is best for Michigan. So we are trying different technologies. Some technologies may work good, okay. Some technologies may work really well. So that's what we are trying to answer. So I wouldn't judge based on just looking at one test section, and we are trying to look at the multiple test sections and see what happens.
So I'm understanding this to mean that there is a possible, we'll be tentative here, solution on the way, but it's going to take time. And all this debate we have about roads and spending and materials will continue. We just need some patience.
That's right. That's right.
Dr. Eamon Kutai, an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Michigan State University. We've been talking about his ongoing research funded by a grant from the state of Michigan into improving our asphalt blends for our roadways. Dr. Kutai, thank you for explaining all this to me today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Thanks.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
It had been 5 decades since the city of Cleveland was granted the opportunity to celebrate a pro sports championship. Yes, you would have to turn the clock back to 1964 when the Cleveland Browns defeated the Baltimore Colts to win the NFL championship, anchored by the great Jim Brown. But That all came to an end last night. LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers stunned the NBA world by defeating the Golden State Warriors in a thrilling Game 7, a 93-89 the final. And that win put an end to the nightmare that is Cleveland sports. And to put it all in perspective, just how monumental this accomplishment is, and to give us a preview of which MSU Spartans hope to hear their name called in the NBA draft later this week, we welcome current sports host Al Martin to the show. And good morning, Al. It is so nice to meet you in person.
Isn't that crazy? We were just joking behind the glass, Brooke, that this we've met via email, but this is our first time meeting in person on the air. So,
on the air.
Pretty cool stuff. Hello, how are you doing? Nice to meet you, Brooke.
I'm good. Thanks. Nice to meet you. So, 52 years. That is so crazy for Cleveland.
Unbelievable, right? I mean, this is just stunning. Stunning. I mean, when looking at history for this series, for just looking at the Cleveland Cavaliers alone here, I mean, we can go in depth about the whole Cleveland curse in just a second, but this is the first team in NBA postseason history to ever come back after being down 3-1 in a series, which is monumental. When you look at, you know, the win percentages for home teams in an NBA playoff series, well, just the NBA Finals alone, 15-3 record coming into this game for the home teams to play in a Game 7 in the NBA Finals. Overall in playoff history, the home team was 101-24 in overall playoff history. So the cards were certainly stacked against LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers. I was sitting there. I actually chose Golden State to win this series in six. Went to seven. I said, there's no way that the Golden State Warriors, by the way, the best regular season team in NBA history, breaking the Chicago Bulls record back in 1995, 1996 of going 72-10. Golden State went 73-9 this year. I mean, I just couldn't believe that Golden State would lose at Oracle Arena. It happened, and Cleveland, I'm so happy because it's been way too long, as you just alluded to, Brooke.
And it was tied at one point, correct?
It was. In that third quarter, it was a back-and-forth game. There were so many lead changes as it went down to the wire. This is something that we haven't seen throughout this NBA Finals because every game has been a blowout. It hasn't been a real intriguing series from the standpoint of every matchup going down to the wire. We finally saw it, and how fitting that it came in a Game 7, the final game of the NBA year. The two teams went at it, and at the end of the day, LeBron James was simply fantastic. He followed up his back-to-back 41-point games with a triple-double, the first triple-double in a Game 7 in the NBA Finals since 1988 when Mr. James Worthy did that for the Los Angeles Lakers. So just mind-blowing stuff.
So, okay, so what does this do, mentioning LeBron James, so what does this do to his legacy, this victory now?
Now that LeBron James has returned to his home state of Ohio and delivered a championship, you can't criticize the dude anymore. I used to be one of those guys that said, okay, when he had the whole decision on ESPN, the hour-long special.
Do you remember that? That was brutal.
I remember it vividly. I'm sitting there saying, okay, this is a guy sitting in a chair during an interview for an hour just about the decision that he's going to make, whether to stay with his current team or take his talents elsewhere. And I'm sitting there saying, this is crazy. And I think LeBron, you know, that was a time early on in his career, you know, when he went to Miami and he kind of reflected on it, he's admitted that maybe that was a mistake. So he returned to Cleveland. He wanted to bring a championship back to his home state. And in this whole Cleveland curse, which, again, dates back till after the 60s, right, which still is crazy. So I think for LeBron's legacy, I mean, he's 3-4 in the NBA Finals now. So he has three NBA championships. He had a triple-double in the Game 7 last night, 27 points, 11 rebounds, 11 assists. And, you know, I think LeBron, just something about LeBron James, he's done it his way. You know, despite all of the critics, despite all of the LeBron haterade out there, LeBron has still said, you know what? This is me. This is who I am. And this is how I go about winning championships in the NBA. So that's something I admire as well. So LeBron has done it his way, and now he has come full circle with doing what he set out to do when he returned to Cleveland.
So arguably the best player in the NBA?
Oh, it's not even an argument anymore. Even though Steph Curry,
right,
who was outstanding this year, but Steph didn't show up. Let's be real here. If we're going to hold LeBron James accountable when he comes short, we have to do the same thing for the first unanimous MVP in NBA history in Steph Curry. Steph did not show up in this series. LeBron James showed you that as far as best all-around player, getting teammates involved, scoring, rebounding, LeBron's a total package. You will not find a better all-around player on today's planet, let alone here in the nation.
Okay, so let's go back to the Golden State Warriors. Does this, I mean, they were fabulous the whole season, the whole regular season, with a record of 73-9. So what does this do for them?
It dilutes it. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, you look at what the 95-96 Bulls were able to accomplish. You know, they held the record previous to the Golden State Warriors this season, and they capped it off with an NBA championship, as you should. When you go 72-10 or 73-9, it means nothing if you don't at the end, you know, when the summer month comes, if you're not hoisting up that NBA championship trophy, it means absolutely nothing. But I do think it does hold some validity, seeing as though they did win the championship last year. So they showed that this is a very consistent team, a very consistent franchise with a lot of talent. You better believe Golden State is going to be foaming at the mouth to get some revenge next year.
Oh, I'm sure. Okay, so now let's switch it up. A few MSU men's basketball players hoping to make their NBA dreams come true this week. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, I think it's a shoe-in right now for Denzel Valentine and Deontay Davis to be picked as first-round draft picks. Every forum I read, every mock draft that I pull up online has Denzel going somewhere between 15 and 25, and Deontay Davis maybe even going earlier than that. So I mean, these were two fantastic players in college. I mean, Denzel Valentine, I mean, he's waking up in the morning, tripping over National Championship Player of the Year, well, National Player of the Year awards, you know. So Denzel Valentine was fantastic throughout his 4 years here at Michigan State. Think about Deontay Davis, though. I mean, he left after just 1 year with the Michigan State men's basketball program. And there's many people out there. I think the general consensus out there is that Deontay Davis could have stayed a bit longer to hone many areas of his game. But, you know, the NBA draft is all about potential as well. And, you know, big men, you can get a guard, you know, left and right. But big men are so hard to come by that when you look at the potential ceiling for a guy like Deontay Davis, people look at that and say, you know what, this is a guy that we can hone when he gets to the league. So Denzel Valentine, Deontay Davis will certainly go in the first round. The other two names to look for are Bryn Forbes and Matt Costello. I don't think, personally, either one of those guys are going to get drafted, maybe to a free agent contract this summer.
Okay, so what about the Pistons? Do you have any idea?
And you know, this is always a catch 22 talking about the Pistons, you know, because I grew up a Detroit Pistons fan, probably the only franchise that I'm a legit fan of still as a reporter. But you know, the Pistons, you know, they finished 44-38 this past season. They made the playoffs for the first time dating back to the early 2000s, right? Which I was just happy for. So they had the 18th overall pick, and possibly right now, what I've seen in some mock drafts is possibly the Pistons are going to try and go after Denzel Valentine if he does fall. They need a big man, and I think they need a backup point guard. And I think Valentine would bode well in possibly filling that void.
So do you think Valentine would like to go to the Pistons? Oh. Have you heard anything?
I don't think he's been asked that question yet. But, I mean, he'll stay in Michigan. His family's here. You know, Carlton Valentine, who, you know, if you look at that history with him and his pops, I mean, Denzel played for his dad here at Lansing Sexton High School. You know, his family would attend every single Michigan State game. Staying here in Michigan would be very cool while also playing in the NBA. So I do think Denzel would love that and will really relish that opportunity. And also, two other names I want to throw out if we have some time. Furkan Korkmaz of Turkey, a Turkey shooting guard. The Pistons are reportedly, they have their eyes on him if they can't get Valentine. And also, Domantas Sabonis, Gonzaga power forward, is also another name to look for as well.
Okay, well, there you have
it. That was a lot, man. I'm out of breath.
You are. I think you need to take a breath.
I do. I need some coffee, right?
You do need some coffee. And if you can tell me where to find it, let me know.
We'll chat after. I got you, Brooke.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Well, there you have it. Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports, which, of course, you can hear weekdays at 1 p.m. on WKAR AM 870 and Current Sports TV, which airs every Thursday night at 10:30 p.m. on WKAR TV. And, of course, Al will have more on the NBA Finals later this afternoon. Later this afternoon, that will all be happening with Al Martin. And Al, it's been a pleasure. And I mean, what are you going to do now that the NBA playoffs are finally over?
Yes, well, now, of course, the attention now shifts to baseball. The Tigers are still playing. They play so many games, though. But I love watching the Tigers. So it shifts to baseball. A lot of golf as well. Dustin Johnson won the U.S. Open this past weekend in a tournament that really came down to the wire. So there's still things to cover. And also, the Michigan Amateur Championship is being played at Eagle Eye starting today. So it's a big event, the first time that Eagle Eye has ever hosted that golf tournament.
So that's great news.
Well, yeah, very good news. And we'll have coverage of that all week. So tune in. It's going to be some intriguing storylines there as well.
All right. Thank you so much, Al.
Thank you, Brooke.
And that's our show for today. Coming up on Tuesday on Current State, a study conducted in a remote area connecting Michigan and Wisconsin, shedding some light on connections between the animal and plant worlds. We'll talk with researchers from Notre Dame University and the Michigan Department of Natural Resources to find out what they learned from that study. Plus, we will open the door to the Barn Theater in Augusta, Michigan, currently celebrating its 70th season. Also coming up, hear from the actor in the current production who made his stage debut at the Barn when he was just 1 year old. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Have a great day.